This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Jim Al-Khalili, and you're about to listen to the quite excellent podcast of The Life Scientific, in which I get top scientists to tell me how they got to where they are today.
My guest today is someone who enjoys being in a crowd, for professional reasons. Stephen Reicher is a social psychologist who's interested in studying how people behave when in a group. To do so, he's often had to immerse himself among the subjects of his studies, from the Bristol riots in 1980 to the millions of Hindu pilgrims who go to the Magh Mela. Some psychologists have said that we lose our identity when we're in a crowd, or that we follow charismatic leaders. But as we'll hear, Stephen Reicher has a different view. He studied at Bristol University in the 1970s when social psychology was just taking off in the UK. Now he's a professor at St Andrews. Today we're at the BBC Radio 3 Free Thinking Festival at Sage Gateshead, where the theme is the one and the many. So my guest and the topic of his Life Scientific fit in perfectly. Stephen Reicher, welcome to Life Scientific. Thank you. Stephen, let's start off with a definition of how a collection of individuals can become what you would define as a group.
Well, perhaps the best way of illustrating that is to draw on an experience which all of us have had, that you get into a train carriage, a crowded train carriage. It's a crowd, it's a physical crowd of people, a lot of people very closely together. But psychologically, you think of yourself very much as an individual. Others are an intrusion upon you. If they look over your shoulder at the same free newspaper that they're reading, you see that as a violation. If they should rub up against you, that it truly is unpleasant. And the train starts off, and then it stops. And you wait, and it stays stopped, and you wait, and it's still stopped. And after a while, there's an announcement, and it's an announcement about the wrong sort of leaves on the line or the wrong sort of rain on the line or whatever it is. And then something shifts, because then you begin to have a sense of yourself as not a set of individuals, but as an aggrieved set of commuters against the train company. There's a sense of we-ness that spreads. People begin to get a sense of shared identity. And when you get that sense of shared identity, that we're not just a disparate collection, we're a set of people who belong to a common social category, things change. People turn to each other. They start to talk to each other. Sometimes, and remember, we're British, they even share their sandwiches. So quite extreme things can happen. So the whole point is we need to distinguish, if you like, between a physical group and a psychological group, which is a set of people who share a common social identity, an identity associated with a membership of a particular social group.
And you've written extensively on the psychology of crowd dynamics. And I read somewhere that you say crowds are the elephant man of the social sciences. what did you mean by that?
Well, people think of the crowd as monstrous. They think that people are somehow less moral in the crowd. They're less mindful in the crowd. They're less rational in the crowd. And all those ideas, I think, are profoundly ideological. They speak to a fear of outsiders rather than an understanding of the actual nature of the phenomenon once you get close to it, once you get inside it, once you map out what actually happens.
And yet we all know how a crowd or a large group gathering of people can be a great uplifting experience, you know, at sports occasions or a music festival.
So yes, groups can do awful things. But the other point is that if it is true that many of the bad things in our society happen in groups, we think of racism and sexism and homophobia, it's equally true that the challenge to these things always happens in groups. So, for instance, if you want to ask, well, how did women get the vote? The answer, obviously, is a suffragette movement. It's women acting collectively to challenge those inequalities. If you want to ask, how did Obama become president? The answer is obviously in the civil rights movement, in the movement of black people. And if you want to talk about the rights of gay people, of course, Stonewall was critical. So, again, the key point is this, that it is in the crowd, when people come together with a sense of shared identity and shared purpose, they become powerful. And the crowd is a source of social power. It's in the crowd that people, for once in their lives, make their own history. They're not subject to the power of others. They make their own history. And that's why crowds, on the whole, are terrifying for those with an interest in the status quo, terrifying for the elite, but at the same time, absolutely exhilarating to those who take part. And if you ask many people the most exciting and exhilarating moment in their life, it will be a crowd, a collective moment, when we came together to change the world.
The opposite is also true sometimes, when a crowd can become a mob. Mm. And maybe even if there isn't any violence. I'm thinking, imagine an example where a crowd, there's some sort of implicit sort of threatening behaviour about it. Imagine I know you're a Spurs fan, you know. So imagine wearing a Spurs scarf but being amongst hundreds of Arsenal supporters. The Arsenal supporters haven't done anything to you. They haven't. But there's that threat that because you don't belong to that group.
Well, the first thing I would say is we need to be very careful about language, because in this area, a lot of the language is not descriptive, it's normative. So people will often talk about mobs, and the whole term mob is to discredit. It's to say, well, these people are, again, thoughtless and mindless. Even the word crowd is somewhat loaded. So, for instance, the example I will often use, you referred to football. Well, today we will be talking about football crowds, because football is a mass and popular entertainment. If we talk about the opera, say, where the masses don't go, we don't talk about the opera crowd. If we do so, we do it so ironically. We talk more about an audience. So this language is part and parcel of the discrediting of crowds. Now, as I say, that's not to deny that crowds can't behave appallingly, that when people collectively feel that their group is under threat, they don't need to feel they're under threat, feel that their group is under threat, or feel that somebody is alien from their group, yes, they can be excluded. But let me describe a study that I did with one of my colleagues, one of my friends, Mark Levine, which involved football fans. And it looked at the other side of the equation, not the negative, the positive. And what we did is we took Manchester United fans, and we said to them, look, we're doing studies on Manchester United fans, but the actual study takes part in another building, so please walk to that building. And so they walked along. Somebody runs along, falls over, hurts themselves. Do they help this person? And this person is either wearing a Manchester United shirt, a Liverpool shirt, or a red T-shirt. Okay. And what you find is they help the person who is wearing a Manchester United shirt. And when that came out, the Liverpool paper had a big headline that scientists prove that Manchester hates us, and Mark was rather nervous about ever going to Liverpool again, but they missed the point. Because the point was we did another condition, and in this other condition we again take exactly the same population, we take Manchester United fans. This time we say to them we're interested in football fans, a more inclusive identity. And again, they go to another building, somebody falls over wearing a Manchester United, a Liverpool or a red T-shirt. And this time they help the person wearing the Manchester United shirt and the Liverpool shirt. So one of the critical things that we learn is, yes, it might be true that we behave in particular ways towards the in-group and the out-group. But one of the things about human behaviour that is quite distinctive is that the boundaries of us and them are flexible. And the ways in which we define boundaries of us and them is highly consequential. The critical question is, how do we define us? Who is of us? Who belongs to us? And therefore, who gets that support? Who is part of the power of the group?
Well, Stephen Rusher, as the son of Jewish immigrants, you were expected, I believe, to become a doctor. I just wanted to dig into this a little bit. But you found psychology more interesting. Was your family background an influence on your choice?
Oh, it was certainly an influence. I mean, from quite young, I discovered and I read about the Holocaust. And for me, it radicalised me politically. It didn't make me religious in any way. But what it said to me is that governments and laws aren't always right. There have to be other, more basic principles. It made me acutely aware of issues of inequality and prejudice and racism. Now, you're right. You're dealing in stereotypes, but it's accurate, this one. My parents wanted my brother to be a lawyer. He failed and became rich instead. Well, he's probably become rich as a lawyer. But, and I was to become a doctor, and I failed, and I became an academic.
Your mother wasn't pleased, I believe, with your career
My
choice.
Mother was not pleased. I still remember on a bus on the Hills Road in Cambridge, and I said to Mum, I said, you know that place I've got in medicine? She said, yes. I said, I decided to turn it down. And she burst into wails of misery and told me how I was ruining my life and her life. I think anybody who was on that bus will remember it still. So I am sorry to be such a failure.
But you did go on to study psychology, social psychology, and you've been studying riots on and off since your days in Bristol.
I was a nice boy once. And I came from a nice family. And in my first year, there was an occupation of Senate House in Bristol. It was about a nursery. It was really about women's access. And I was terrified. I thought, oh, God, what will happen to me if I join these people my mother warned me against? Now, I'd gone to university, probably like many people, thinking it was going to be a hive of intellectual activity where we would stay till late in the night discussing ideas. And I discovered it wasn't at all like that. It was a place that you went drinking until late in the night and then missed the lectures in the morning. And the one place I found this was in the occupation. I mean, in this crowd, we would stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning discussing issues of principle, of women's access, of tactics. And it was exhilarating. So I discovered, even as I was learning my classic group psychology of how groups are bad for you, just how invigorating groups were. So I was very excited in groups. I was very excited about the power of groups and how you harness the power of groups and how you mobilise people to challenge inequality. And I was sitting in my laboratory at Bristol University doing social influence experiments when the St Paul's riots happened. So, of course, I rushed down there and there was a cordon around St Paul's, and the police looked at me and they said, Sonny, I was young at the time, they said, Sonny, they said, you can't go in there, there's a riot going on. And I said to them, it's OK, I'm a psychologist, I study crowds. And they looked at me and said, OK, you can go through. Now, to this day, I've never been sure where they did that because they thought, he looks clever, he can solve it. Or they thought, well, he's a bloody student, who cares what happens to him? But I do have my suspicions. But I looked at St Paul's, and again, the headlines the next day are the headlines you will always see after riots. They said, mad mob. They said, people going on the rampage. They gave this image of an explosion where people do just anything. And as I looked closely, I found patterns of what people did do and didn't do. That when a stone was thrown at a big corporate enterprise, a bank, you know, a chain shop, then others joined in. If it was thrown at the local shop, people didn't join in. If a stone was thrown at the police, it became collective. If it was thrown at a bus, it didn't. There were clear patterns and limits to what people did. And what's more, those limits made sense in people's collective understanding of themselves as being from St Paul's. Because the St Paul's experience, it wasn't that everybody was black, but being from St Paul's was experienced as if you were black. If you came from St Paul's, you were seen as problematic, you would have problems getting jobs, you would be treated differently by the police. It was a racialized identity, and the targets expressed that. And so I began to see that the social identity, this collective self, governed the limits of what people did. That unlike the stereotypes, the notion that you just do anything, you get swept up, there's contagion, you always find limits to crowd behavior.
More recently, I know, you studied the 2011 English riots, and these studies did come from some rather considered thought after the event. But you also you immerse yourself in a crowd, whether it's a riot or whatever. What can you learn by being in amongst the crowd? I mean, presumably people, you know, who are demonstrating, for example, aren't going to be quite so prepared to be interviewed by a psychologist who wants to ask them some questions about their motivation.
Yeah, you can go up to people and say, look, before you throw that rock, can you fill in this questionnaire? But it's not that successful. I've always believed in multiple methods, and I've always been rather concerned by the ways in which our discipline, psychology, often abstracts behaviour from reality. The point of psychology is not to explain what goes on in our experiments. It's to use our experiments to try and understand the processes which help us explain what goes on in the real world. So the first point of any good science is to map the phenomena. Observation comes at the very start. You've got to, if you like, generate good hypotheses before you can answer them. Now, the odd thing about crowd psychology historically is it's been almost a science without a referent. It's been based on fantasies of what the crowd is like rather than the realities. And the most obvious example of that is one of the most prevalent classical explanations is the notion of de-individuation. In the crowd, people become anonymous, and that anonymity leads to all sorts of things. Now, however good the experiments on the effects of anonymity, there's just one problem. Most people in the crowd aren't anonymous. Most people in the crowd go along with their friends. Most people in the crowd know each other. So the explanation is irrelevant to the nature of the phenomenon. Now, I think that means that we need very much a multi-method approach. We need to immerse ourselves in the phenomena to understand the phenomena. We need, obviously, then to retreat, if you like, from the phenomena to undertake more controlled studies about the processes that we think are going on. So at the moment, I have a grant with John Drury and Fergus Neville, also Clifford Stock, looking at this notion of contagion. Part of these are very simple, low-level studies asking that, if I yawn, do you yawn? And is that dependent on my social relationship to you, whether you're in-group or out-group? If I scratch, do you scratch? Then looking at showing people violence and responses to violence, and how do I respond to that? And then finally, and this comes back to your earlier question, finally mapping the spread of violence in the 2011 riots. And asking the question that if you look at that spread, can we explain it by simple mechanical factors? Is it simply exposure to the riots? Well, actually, the more you think about it, the more that's a silly explanation. I mean, you and I saw the riots on television. I'm assuming you didn't go out and riot. Perhaps you have a secret life I don't know about. But I can tell you I didn't go out and riot. And a lot of people who saw the riots went out and cleaned up after the riots. So plainly, contagion doesn't happen. So we're trying to examine whether you can better explain it by, if you like, that sense of shared identity, that people see themselves in those who rioted. So our aim is to map that spread, to find proxies, if you like, for shared identity, and see if that can then mathematically model the spread of crowds. So as I say, I think studying crowds partly is exhilarating because they're fascinating things, and partly it's a wonderful puzzle because it's so difficult.
Stephen, you're talking about crowds and, and contagion. In, for example, the 2011 riots, there were a few who we might call troublemakers in the crowd.
Yes.
You have this issue about culpability, don't you? I mean, you know, that, you know, if there is someone who does, throws a rock but someone else stands back, well, they're also culpable in the sense because they're part of that crowd.
Well, there are legal issues, and actually I think there are some really fascinating legal issues which stem from the notion of social identity. Let me just pose one, and but then I'll go back to the specific issue of the riot. See, the whole notion of legal culpability is the person in the dock is the same person who committed the act. If you have a notion of multiple social identities, and that we are different and act in different ways when different social identities are salient, then if the individual is multiple psychologically, is it the same person? It is a necessary legal fiction. It might not be an empirical reality. It's a necessary legal fiction that we have a constant and single identity so you can hold people to account. But going back to the issue of culpability, the real issue in crowds is spread. Okay? In many crowds, you will have a few people who you know, who are anti-police or who want to throw stones or whatever. But the real question is, why do the few become the many? Why does the one become the many? Because we only talk of riots if not 5 or 10, but rather 500 or 1,000 people throw rocks. And I would argue that the reason for that is very much to be found in the types of dynamics I talked about earlier. When do different voices gain predominance? In nearly every crowd, you'll have these multiple voices. So what are the factors which give credibility to one rather than the other? And it's very much these interactive processes. It's the police or the authorities aren't only part and parcel of containing violence, they are part and parcel of the production of violence. And they can, if they understand these processes, help to de-escalate rather than to escalate. With violence, as in so many things, it does take two to tango.
Well, let's move away from violence. You've also worked in one of the largest gatherings of people on Earth, the Allahabad Mela in northern India. Right. What were your aims here? What were you studying?
This is a Hindu festival. It happens every year. It's on a 12-year cycle. And every year, over the month, the Magh month, a million or two go. And on the sixth year, about 10 million to 20 million people go. And on the 12th year, 100 million people attend. And I remember standing on a hill, looking around me, and thinking, there's four times the population of Scotland, where I live, around me. Quite phenomenal. Now, we wanted to study the effects of participation. And the good thing about the Mela is because people are there for a month, some of the time they're pretty bored, you can interview them, you can do surveys. And so we did, again, a multi-method study where we did ethnographic work, we did interview work, we did survey work, longitudinal survey work. And indeed, we found that identity, sense of being a Hindu, was strengthened. But we found something else, which I think is one of the most interesting developments, or fits into one of the most interesting developments in social psychology. Now, to understand why this is interesting, you've got to realise that by all the assumptions of mainstream Western psychology, the Mela should be incredibly bad for you. Okay, so number one, it's intensely crowded. And crowding is supposed to be bad for us. It's supposed to stress us. It's incredibly noisy. We measured the noise, and the noise carries on day and night for a month, 24 hours for a month. And the levels of noise are those which, according to WHO guidelines, should cause you harm after 45 minutes. And when it comes to sanitation, millions of people, a rudimentary sewage system, and let me advise you that if you put your foot in the Ganges, don't ask what is floating past your ankles. It should be really bad for you. And what do we find? We find that well-being is increased, that mental well-being is increased, and according to self-reports, we need to follow this up, but even physical well-being is improved. And the mechanism we think that's going on, and this comes out of the longitudinal survey research and the statistical methods you can apply to that, is that because people have got a sense of shared identity, they begin to see others as people who will support them rather than an impediment. This endures into everyday life and it gives people a sense of mastery, it decreases stress, and it improves well-being. So actually a remarkable finding, again, that even if we talk in medical terms, that crowds can be good for you. And so through this, I've suddenly found myself publishing in medical journals, so perhaps my mum would be happy after all.
Another factor, Steve Reicher, of a group is the appearance of leaders. Mm. And you've also studied this role. Does a group have to have a charismatic leader with a particular kind of personality?
To understand leadership, we've got to go back to understanding the group. Because leaders are never just leaders. They're always leaders of a social group. Leaders of other social groups, we look at them and we're amazed by how they achieve influence. They certainly don't sway us. I suspect there might be one or two other people in this audience who agree with me that they look at Margaret Thatcher and they think, how on earth did she have such sway over so many people? And our argument is fundamentally an effective leader is an entrepreneur of identity. They understand, either intuitively or explicitly, these processes, and therefore they are able to position themselves as representing us and speaking for us. And if you master that, you really do have a world-making tool in your hands.
So when you talk about a leader having to represent the group, that doesn't necessarily mean that the leader is identifies as part of that group with the same intentions, with the same ambitions. I mean, if we consider some of the drivers of the current populist movements around the world, say, for example, the election of Donald Trump, I mean, he doesn't represent many of the poor white working class who voted for him.
Well, since I'm on Life Scientific, I have to give you a piece of jargon that you haven't had before. So let me make a distinction between a very important distinction in social psychology between typical and prototypical. Typical means what we would expect it to. Somebody who is typical is somebody who represents, if you like, the mathematical mean of a set of people. But what prototypical means is it's somebody who represents what makes our group distinct from other groups. It's somebody who represents, if you like, the distinctive virtues of our group. But the second point is that to understand the qualities that are needed of a leader, we need to understand the nature of the group that they seek to represent. Or at least they also are active in crafting a consonance, if you like, between the group and themselves. What Trump does is he crafts a consonance between this notion of the ordinary American up against the elite, right, and who he is. He positions himself as the boy from the wrong side of the tracks, not the smooth East Coast Ivy Leaguer, but rather this rough, crude, ordinary man who has achieved the American dream. The man who has exemplified what we want to be, who exemplifies what makes America, you know, or once great and perhaps great again. And in many ways, what was interesting was that Donald Trump, unlike Hillary Clinton, understood that in an anti-political age where politicians are seen as part of this elite, then to break the rules of politics is not a disadvantage. It is, if you do it proudly and clearly enough, becomes an advantage.
And of course, these days we're seeing more and more examples of autocratic leaders around the world consolidating their positions of power. How do you see the dynamic between us, society as a group, and our leaders changing?
Mm-hmm. Well, autocracy comes when the leader elides themselves with the group. I am the group. So if you disagree with me, you aren't of the group. And as soon as you get to that position, then disagreement is no longer a community discussing with itself and moving forward. It's an enemy trying to undermine you. And the sure sign of autocracy is when a leader begins to say that anybody who disagrees with them is not of the group. When Trump says that if a judge disagrees with him, he's Mexican, he's not American. You see it with Erdogan in Turkey. You see it with Orban. Orban famously says that his party, Fidesz, represent the unified will of the Hungarian people. That means anybody who disagrees with them is no longer of the nation, is an enemy. So dictatorship, as much as anything else, lies in defining groups in a particular way, an exclusionary way, a way which does not allow of anyone to have any dissent at all.
We live in fascinating times, and that is all the time we have. So thank you, the audience here at Sage Gateshead's Free Thinking Festival, but please join me in thanking my guest for sharing with us his Life Scientific, Stephen Reicher.
Thank you for listening to this podcast of the Life Scientific. For more information or to listen to other episodes, please search for the Life Scientific on the Radio 4 website.